Welcome to Power Play on a busy March 2nd with political developments breaking out here, south of the border, and overseas. Coming up on today's show, with 200 charges stayed in Alberta over the last 2 months for failing to give the accused a timely trial, we will ask one of the lawyers behind the Supreme Court decision if this is the beginning of a national trend. And Ontario residents are reeling from a shocking increase in hydro bills. Today, the popularity plunging government enacted damage control. A regional panel discusses whether it's too late for the Liberals to surge back to power. And after basking in positive reviews for his speech to Congress, Donald Trump's presidency was rocked by revelations his attorney general lied about meeting with an alleged Russian spy. We will get the latest from Washington. But first, the government fought back against allegations it's blind to an oncoming legal immigration wave. Here's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau reacting earlier today.
We are ensuring that Canada continues to have a strong immigration and refugee system while protecting the integrity of our borders. We have reallocated resources to make sure that we are able to meet the incoming asylum seekers that we are giving support. No, at the same time, we need to make sure that the law is being enforced, that we are going through this process in a rigorous way, and that's exactly what we are continuing to monitor and work with different orders of government and international partners on.
Okay, let's bring in CTV's Omar Sachedina, who will be on this side tomorrow this time. Omar, that was a curious briefing today. I don't see that often where they just have an off or not for attribution thing. But what are they saying in terms of numbers?
Yeah, that's true. And people, they clearly want to get ahead of this, right? Because there's been a lot of questions about this, especially because of the cases we've been seeing and the pictures. They've been so compelling as well. In terms of the numbers, Don, here's the breakdown. If you look at the number of people who are just showing up at border crossings, Canada-US border crossings, and if you compare the period between January to February 21st last year and this year, there has been an increase. So here's how that breaks down. Last year, that number was 728 people. This year, that number is 1,698 people. So these are, again, people showing up at the border.
So what are they showing there?
So this number is the number of people who are making the illegal border crossing. So these are in areas between those official points. And you've got the numbers right there. In Quebec, there were 290. Again, that period between January and February 21st of this year. Mm-hmm. In Manitoba, the number is 94. And in British Columbia, that number is 51. So again, I mean, what are we now? March 2nd? Yeah, exactly. So this only goes back to February 21st. So the number is likely higher. So we're seeing an issue here.
Were the officials in any way saying, you know, we got a problem here. Once spring goes away, we'll have a spring invasion of these illegal immigrations.
No, they seem to be playing this down in a sense because, you know, we've talked a lot about the fact that experts have said that, look, once the weather warms up, people will be more likely to make that desperate journey across. Obviously, the weather's better, so they're willing to go through it. But the officials in the briefing today were saying, you know, they're tracking intelligence, they're watching, they're waiting, they're seeing how there is, but there's nothing to indicate to them that there's going to be this massive influx when the weather improves. So certainly the messaging from these officials is that we're waiting, we're watching, and beyond the normal fluctuations, they're not willing to call it a trend. Although, if you compare that seven-week period, mm-hmm. the numbers indicate that we have seen an increase. So there seems to be a bit of a conflict there in the messaging.
I find it interesting whether some people are covering Mexico, saying Mexico is ready to unleash into the United States and these people are make a beeline for our border. Is there any indication that that's happening, or are these U.S. approved refugees?
Haven't really seen any indication that these are overwhelmingly Mexicans coming in. What the officials mentioned today, they mentioned a few countries. They mentioned Djibouti, Somalia, Romania, and those were the primary nationalities or citizenships that were mentioned today. What they also mentioned in this briefing is that in the past 2 weeks, a lot of the people who were crossing illegally were on valid U.S. visas or passports. So that's the other interesting thing. They're coming in. In some cases, they've applied for refugee status in the U.S., but they've decided it's taken too long. They're scared, perhaps, that because of Donald Trump's immigration clampdown, they may be deported. And so they're basically trying their hand at the Canadian system. And as we know, the Safe Third Country Agreement says that if you've applied for refugee status in the U.S., you can't do that at legal border crossing in Canada. So that's why we're seeing people try illegally. And according to the UN conventions that Canada has signed on to, once a person steps foot in Canada, it's our international obligation to give that person a fair hearing.
Okay, and so far there's no sign that you're being arrested, or there's no deportation orders coming out of these numbers that we've seen so far.
No arrests, and nobody's been charged with anything either for crossing the border.
All right, Omar, thanks for briefing us. Appreciate that one. Oh. Have fun tomorrow.
Always a pleasure.
All right, to the U.S. now, where the calm was short before the storm returned to Donald Trump's world. Revelations broke today, which threatened his new attorney general. Well, let's get the story from our intrepid Washington correspondent, Richard Madden. Richard, the attorney general had a news conference just in the last hour. What did Mr. Sessions have to say?
It was an extraordinary news conference by the embattled attorney general. Jeff Sessions says he will recuse himself from any investigation linked to Russian election hacking and the Trump campaign. This is after the Washington Post dropped that bombshell of report suggesting that he, too, spoke to the Russian ambassador during the campaign on at least two occasions, which contradicted his testimony during his confirmation hearing, said he did no such thing. This, of course, has darkened the cloud of suspicion on the Trump administration on just what exactly are these Russian ties between the campaign, the administration, and the Russians. So Sessions, of course, insisting he did nothing wrong, saying that he routinely met with ambassadors during his tenure as senator. But this is just really raising a lot of eyebrows. How could he not know or recall that he spoke to the Russian ambassador during his confirmation hearings when, let's face it, that happened in September, when stories about Russian interference during the election was dominating the news cycle, Sessions insisting he didn't recall. But here he was today having his news conference several months later, recalling the conversations he did have with the Russian ambassador, saying they talked about terrorism, they talked about economics, but they didn't discuss the campaign at all, which has a lot of Democrats saying, I don't believe that at all. Democrats are smelling blood. They're calling him to resign. But for now, Sessions is saying that he's going to step aside while this investigation continues. Bottom line, Don, really bad day for the Trump administration.
I'm curious, though, you know, I wonder if these people ever communicate amongst each other, because the president was on that aircraft carrier and he said, no, I don't see any reason for Mr. Sessions to recuse himself from further investigations into this Russian connection. Sessions says, oh, yeah, I passed that along. I mean, don't they know how to send messages to each other?
Well, we've seen the pattern in this White House. Internal communication isn't the greatest quality inside the Trump administration. Trump, you're right, did say he has total support for Jeff Sessions. He believes he told the truth during his confirmation hearing, and he didn't think that Sessions should step aside while this investigation continues. Obviously, Sessions had a different tact, and he is doing it. And this, of course, is what many top Republicans have pushed Sessions to do. Even Paul Ryan says if Sessions becomes the subject of a probe, that, yeah, he should step aside. So, you know, Sessions is feeling the heat, but the Trump White House thinks that they can weather this storm. Ultimately, though, Don, Donald Trump had two really positive news cycles after his joint session before Congress. That's been knocked off the agenda as the topic once again turns to suspicions about the Trump White House and their collusions with Russia. Remember, Trump lost Mike Flynn, his national security advisor, over his conversations with the Russian ambassador. And now Jeff Sessions is on the defensive. And in this city, the belief and the word from top U.S. intelligence is that the Russian ambassador is a top spy for the Russians, and he's also a big recruiter of spies. So he is not a well-liked person among the intel folks here. And for Sessions to have these conversations with him and then testifying before a committee saying he didn't recall doing it, that just doesn't make him look good. This is a tough one for him to dig himself out of.
All right, Richard, you sound as incredulous as I am about this, but I'm sure it's not over yet. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Not at all. Thanks, Don.
All right, back to news in this country. Ontario and Quebec were supposed to lead the way on criminal cases being stayed after a Supreme Court ruling that demanded timely justice for the accused. But Alberta has hit what overworked Crown prosecutors described as a breaking point, which saw 200 charges stayed in the last 2 months. Here's a reaction from Alberta's Justice Minister.
We do support taking a more rationalized approach to it, rather than just having the court choose which matters wind up getting stayed. So I think they're concerned, and so are we.
All right, the concept of justice delayed being justice denied has its roots in this Supreme Court ruling, as I was saying, that imposes limits on how long the accused can wait for a trial before it's thrown out. One of the lawyers who was involved in that decision, known as the Jordan case, is Eric Gotardi. He's the senior partner at Peck & Company. He joins us from Vancouver. All right, Eric, are you surprised that Alberta did a sort of a blanket discharge of these 200 cases? Is that an expected offshoot from the Jordan ruling?
Well, I'm a little bit surprised. You know, we were aware when the case went up to the court that different provinces were at different stages of trouble or crisis in their delay problem. Ontario had problems. We knew Alberta had a problem. The problem's not so bad in British Columbia. I'm a little surprised they went ahead and stayed them, because the court went out of its way in Jordan to give all of the provinces kind of a grace period, a transitional period, before the new law kind of essentially came into full effect. And so even though there's a number of these cases that are on the bubble in terms of time, I really wondered how many of those were going to materialize into stays of proceedings, or in other words, cases being thrown out.
Yeah, you wonder, like, there in some of these are weapons cases, there's some impaired driving charges that are being dropped. I guess I wonder if they would have been plea bargained or, as you say, dropped in any event.
Well, I think, you know, if Jordan, I mean, Jordan is a big change in the law, and it's a kind of a wake-up call to all participants in the justice system to try and look at things and do things in a different way. You know, this kind of adversarial system where everything's a fight hasn't worked in terms of solving the delay problems, and the court was frustrated that after 20 years of admonitions to the courts and the prosecutors and defense lawyers that we still weren't getting it right. And so, you know, I'm hopeful that, you know, the parties, all the participants in the system are going to try to think about doing things differently. And one of those things would be moving some more minor charges just out of the criminal courts completely, and making room and making time for the really serious cases.
Yeah, this idea of dispensing with preliminary hearings, you don't believe that that's a way to shortcut the process?
No, I really think it's a bit of a red herring. There's no evidence, there's no connection between preliminary inquiries and delay. And a number of years ago, it might even be 10 years ago now, Parliament made a number of changes in relation to the preliminary inquiry to make it a much more streamlined process. So it's really an important step. And in a lot of cases, what I hear from Crown prosecutors that I deal with, and I prosecute cases as well, it's a chance for the Crown to see what the quality of the evidence is going to be at trial. And sometimes after that, there's a plea if the case is really strong, or if the case isn't strong at all, and surprisingly so, the Crown can stay the charges and the case never gets to trial. So It's still a procedure that has utility, and it's just a Band-Aid idea for people to say we should get rid of it, and that's somehow going to fix the problem.
I guess people, particularly victims who are seeing people they regard as criminals getting off, want to point blame at somebody. I mean, are you to point at the federal system or the provincial system, or is there enough blame to go around for everybody for all these delays?
Well, there's enough blame to go around. You know, one of the key things in the court that we argued on Jordan was that, you know, everyone suffers when a case doesn't get decided on the merits. Believe it or not, you know, the accused really does want to have a speedy trial in most cases. The victim does. You know, it doesn't serve anyone's interest for it to take 3 and 4 years to get to a trial. But it's really only when cases are getting tossed out and there's lots of media attention and headlines that members of the public pay attention. And then politicians pay attention. And we're at that stage now, and Jordan has kind of put us in that position. So the spotlight is on the system, but there needs to be, you know, more judges appointed. There's many vacancies still now. We need more judges, more courtrooms, more Crown prosecutors, and we need for defense lawyers to be properly funded under legal aid. So the whole system needs to be properly and better resourced to make it function more smoothly.
All right, we'll see what that happens. All right, Eric, thanks for appreciate you joining us.
Thanks, Don.
All right, after the break, we'll tap into our roving expert on all the worst places in the world to discuss our government's new foreign aid for abortions and the Kurdish Special Forces who are accused of torturing children. Please stay with us. Canada is helping fill the funding void left by the U.S. canceling foreign aid to agencies counseling or performing abortions. For this and a whole lot more on International Aid, award-winning author and War Child Canada founder Samantha Nutt joins us from Toronto. Oh, Sam, we always have such happy topics to talk about. But there is a lot of foreign aid required and not enough to deliver to all the causes. Is Canada right, in your view, to donate $20 million to replace Donald Trump's cash withdrawal on these foreign agencies that perform abortion?
Canada is right to contribute, and they just came out of this conference in Europe where an appeal was put forward to try to supplement some of the money. But, I mean, we're talking about a $600 million shortfall as a result of Trump's decision to withhold those funds to agencies that are providing either abortion services or abortion counseling and reproductive health services. It's actually, frankly, a bit vague, so people are quite concerned around who is going to be caught up in all of this. But that $600 million, Canada's responded with $20 million, as have some other Scandinavian countries. Hopefully, I mean, that's still a long way from $600 million, Don, and that's the big concern on top of Trump's pledged or promised to cut about 30 to 37% of aid funding through the State Department and USAID, and we're not sure what that means. So we're talking about billions of dollars at risk here.
But, you know, Canada's a bit of a slouch in foreign aid, too, isn't it? I mean, shouldn't we be picking up the pace anyway and maybe going a little to help close that gap a bit more?
Absolutely. I think that we should. Canada right now in 2015, which is the last year that the numbers are available for, we were about $15 billion. We're still woefully short of that UN target of 0.7% that was set by our very own Lester B. Pearson in 1969. So we too could go a lot further in terms of increasing our aid contributions around the world. And it's so necessary right now. We've got the worst refugee crisis since World War II with more than 60 million people displaced from their homes. We have a massive famine that's taking place in South Sudan with millions of people at risk. So now is the time for Canada and, frankly, for Canadians to be generous and to try to dig deep and to try to offset some of these egregious cuts to human rights agencies all around the world.
I mean, you're back from, you were over in Iraq, I believe, last month or so, and you've dealt with children in war settings all over Africa and the Middle East. And I'm just curious, you know, we've got a new protocol of sorts on how to deal with child soldiers, yet there's some stories out that sounds like our allies in the Kurdish Special Forces didn't get that memo. What have you seen and heard about child soldiers under Kurdish detention?
Well, I am just back from the region, from Iraq, a few weeks ago, and I was in the prisons. I was interviewing young men who have been caught up in this crisis, who are minors. And as the advance in Mosul was taking place, these were young men who were forced into various forms of service with ISIS, many of them running errands, for example, or cooking for them and that kind of thing. And because they can't be cleared from a security perspective, they are detained. Some of them are detained in special security forces prisons. There have been allegations of torture of some of these minors, and certainly those were the stories that I heard when I visited the prisons. And so what's happening is that these young boys between the ages of 11 and 15, they are effectively child soldiers. They, in many instances, were forced to provide these kinds of services to ISIS, and they're being denied the opportunity to have rehabilitation and to be reintegrated with their communities. And their communities are not being reintegrated either, Dawn. I should make that very clear. Many of them are in camps right now that are being administered by those special security forces, and their movements are being highly limited because there are security concerns there as well. So these kids don't even have access to their parents or to lawyers, and it's very disconcerting. And I would agree with you that here we have Canada putting out this comprehensive document on how to deal with young people caught up in conflict as child soldiers, and yet meanwhile, with the work that's happening right now in Iraq certainly isn't upholding those standards.
Wow. Well, you've been warning me, both on the air and off air, about the deteriorating conditions in South Sudan for many months, and you referenced it off the top. There's a famine now. How bad, how long, and what can or should be done by Canadians?
It is bad. It has been looming for a while. Now it has been officially declared a famine. There are millions of people at risk. It is the result of a declining security situation that has been taking place over the last couple of years. War Child's been actively involved in the region now for many years. In fact, we are involved in food security and making sure that families have access to the tools and the resources and the supplies that they need, the inputs that they need to have food security. But unfortunately, as a result of this decline in security and access points have been cut off. There are many millions of people who are at risk, and Canada has been quite generous up until this point. But it is a crisis that has slipped from the global radar. We have been focusing on other crises, so it's not surprising that this one has crept up on the international community. And it is time for us to respond vigorously, and we have to sustain that. We are heading into a drought. This is a problem that's going to last for many months, and the longer it drags out, the more families will be at risk. So we have to be in this for the long haul.
Sad state of affairs. Sam and Mathenat, thanks for joining us. Appreciate the gloomy update, but thanks anyway.
Thanks, Don.
All right, coming up, the monthly opening of the hydro bill has become a shocking ritual for Ontario consumers. Today, the government moved to short-circuit voter anger by announcing a dramatic rate cut. Our Ontario panel comes up right after these messages. Welcome back. Well, with her popularity in a free fall and an election just over 1 year away, Ontario Premier Kathleen Wynne threw the breakers on a steep power rate cut in a desperate bid to avoid future shock. Here's Kathleen Wynne.
We are tripling the size of the cut we're making to people's hydro bills from 8% to an average of 25%.
All right, let's call in the Ontario panel who are ready to cover all the waterfront on this high-voltage issue. Seamus Murphy is of Council Public Affairs. He leans towards Liberal sympathies. Joining us from Toronto, Will Stewart, Navigator, has deep Conservative connections, and Tom Parkin is an NDP strategist. All right, gentlemen, the polls for the current government are in a shocking state. So I guess Kathleen Wynne has made the ultimate power play. I guess I'll go to you first, Seamus. Is this going to work?
Well, Don, you know, there's an old saying in politics that winning the fifth mandate is the hardest. But I think for Premier Wynne, this is her leadership at work. She spoke to Ontarians, she heard from them about this issue, and today, before making this announcement, called a number of the people who'd written to her about hydro rates to tell them what she was going to do. And I was surprised at the size of the announcement. A 25% reduction across the board is really significant, 40 to 50% for some of those who are the hardest hit. And how did she do it? By amortizing the cost of energy infrastructure from instead of 20 years, over 30 years, and by shifting social programs for some of the hardest hit Ontarians off of the hydro rate base onto the tax base. How can they do that? Because they're going to have a balanced budget in the spring. So, you know, I think, you know, is this, hopefully it will take the issue of hydro rates off the table, but I think that the Premier did this because it was the right thing to do.
Okay, will this take the issue of power rates off the table?
No, of course not. And, you know, I think I will agree with one thing that Seamus said, that this is Kathleen Wynne's leadership, I'd say lack of leadership at work. This is just yet another attempt to put a Band-Aid on a massive hemorrhage of a problem that of their own making. First off, the podium sign that says 25% reduction and key message reported by Seamus here from the, right from the Premier's office on your show, it's not 25%, it's 17%. And that's on top of the 10% that they put back on your bills last time. This change today does nothing but add more cost to the tax base and more cost to future generations. I have a 10-year-old son. He will be my age when we finish paying for Kathleen Wynne's announcement today.
All right, Tom, the NDP tried to get ahead of this curve. They had their own plan rolled out, I think, about a week ago. Do you think the NDP has any choice but to support this situation?
No, this is unsupportable. The NDP plan actually tried to attack some of the underlying costs of hydro. It talked about the overbuild in supply. It addressed the incredibly lucrative windfall contracts in private energy suppliers, and it addressed some of the core issues that are driving the cost of electricity in Ontario. The Liberal plan fixes nothing. It just extends the debt into the future. It makes bankers very happy. Unfortunately for Will, his party doesn't have a plan for anything. The NDP is actually proposing a plan that is trying to fix the system. So I think there's a good debate that's going to be coming now, whether simply pushing costs into the future is sufficient to make people happy, or whether people really want somebody to attack the driving costs in the system.
You know, Seamus, this thing has been developing over years. This has not just popped out in the last 6 months. Why on earth do they wait so long to provide this relief? We've seen people, women have confronted Kathleen Wynne. They've gone to her and said, look, this is my bill then.
Sure.
Look at it now. I mean, this looks like pretty bland and opportunism more than anything else.
Well, you know, in fact, Don, it goes back even further than that. I mean, Dalton McGuinty inherited a province that had not had any significant energy investment since 1980, and that's under previous Liberal, NDP, and Conservative governments. And, you know, phased out coal, introduced renewables, ended blackouts and brownouts. But there were some issues with the system that was put in place, and that was that the costs were amortized over too short a period of time, and that the attempts to help with the energy costs for people from low-income communities or from rural and remote communities was also borne by the hydro rate base. And those are issues that Kathleen Wynne has fixed, you know, just past the halfway point of her mandate. So, you know, I think she listened and she's come forward with a sweeping set of changes to address this problem.
Well, I guess I got to ask you, Tom's got a point here. The Conservatives haven't rolled out their version of how they would try and provide power rate relief. What is your answer to that?
I think it's a fair point. I think if you look back over the history of political election campaigns, certainly over the last three or four in Ontario, the Liberal government has seen what the Conservatives have come up with, copied it, and tried to demonize them through paid advertising that they use for cash, that they get money for from Cash for Access fundraisers. I think Patrick Brown is right to keep his powder dry. He's got a plan for this. He'll be rolling it out in a systematic way. I mean, you look at Seamus, what he had to say, and I was betting Tom before we came on the air how long it would be before he mentioned previous Conservative governments. I think people need to realize that that's a little bit stale now after this government has been in power for 14 years, and the person they're referring to, Mike Harris, was elected in 22 years ago. Seamus, it's time to come into the 21st century here. You guys messed this up. You guys are trying to fix it. And this won't be the last announcement. They tried in September, 8% reduction. Oh, that wasn't enough. Now, 25% reduction, which is really 17% reduction. But don't worry, it's going on the tax base. That means higher taxes coming in the budget if they're going to get to balance. This is a shell game of epic proportions. They've been caught. Everybody sees it today. It's embarrassing, frankly, for this government.
The trouble is, Tom, of course, that people are going to be opening much smaller power bills in the next few months, and they have short memories. Is there a concern here from the NDP perspective that voters will forgive and forget, or more likely forget than forgive?
There's issues from the past, and there's issues that are from before today that have built into the price of hydro. There was the new meter program that spent $1 billion that was untendered and has been a disaster. There was a power plant that was never built, and that cost a further $1 billion. There's an oversupply in the system, and we're selling electricity under cost to our competitor jurisdictions. There's just a litany, and the power supply contracts, 20 years at windfall rates. There's a litany of failures of business bad privatization decisions that have been made over the last number of years under the Liberals that are built in. Now, to wipe those away and push those forward in the future, it may make for some ease on the bill every month. But I think it just transfers and transforms that unease into the Premier herself, who really has really not addressed the problem and can't admit to all these things that she's done over the last, her and her party have done over the last number of years. So I don't think it, all right, I don't think it ends, it just changes.
All right, it's a message. If you want to get voters angry, get those power bills way up. All right, thank you all. We'll see if this thing spools out as successful damage control or not. Might take a few months to figure that out. Coming up after the break, we'll connect with a Washington blitzing cabinet minister who had an out-of-this-world experience today when he reconnected with his old hangout on the International Space Station. Please stay with us. Welcome back. Former astronaut Mark Garneau was in his old element today talking to the current occupants of the International Space Station. But his political feet are grounded on transportation issues as our cabinet minister on the file. He's part of that ongoing blitz of Washington to connect with the new Trump administration. And Mark Garneau joins us from the Canadian Embassy in Washington, D.C. Minister Garneau, you talked to these ISS astronauts today. Get a little nostalgic?
Yes, I did. It made me want to be back up there. It was very nice to talk to two crew members up on the International Space Station, one of whom I had worked with in the 90s.
Wow. All right. I want to get things back down to earth here. You're trying to keep Canada-U.S. transportation issues running smoothly. What sort of border traversing feedback did you get from the Trump people you met?
I thought it was very positive. Don, we have 30,000 trucks that cross the border every single day. I'm talking in both directions. About 4,600 rail cars that cross the border, about 400,000 Americans and Canadians that cross the border. We really move across the borders. And of course, the two messages I had was we need to have to continue to build good infrastructure at our border crossings, things like bridges and other kinds of crossings. And the second thing is, when all of that stuff moves across the border, we need to have the same regulations on both sides of the border, whether it applies to trucks or trains, so that those people transporting the goods don't have to switch to a different set of regulations. That would make things complicated. So harmonizing regulations was another message I carried today.
And what are they saying to you? A lot of this is a learning curve from the Trump administration about what Canada is all about. Are they putting up any red flags to that sort of symmetrical relationship getting even better?
Not on the transportation side. I think things went very smoothly. The harmonization between the two countries has really been exceptional when it comes to transportation. And of course, this is so crucial to the economies of the two countries, moving those goods as efficiently as possible. So I got very positive feedback with respect to continuing the way we've done things in the past in terms of how we approach transportation in both our countries.
And what about aviation transportation? What are the concerns there and what are they asking you about?
Well, actually, that's a very interesting point that you bring up. I met with five congressmen and senators today, as well as meeting with Secretary Chow. And they expressed some interest in the way we manage air traffic control in our country, our airspace. There's an organization called NAVCAN that we created about 20 years ago that manages Canada's airspace. And they're looking at possibly making changes in the way they manage their airspace. It's the FAA or the Federal Aeronautics Administration that is currently responsible for it. And they asked if they could learn more about how we do it in Canada. And in fact, I think this is going to lead to a mission to Ottawa in the not too distant future. And if we of course said we'd be happy to share and provide whatever information that we can. NAVCAN is a very well-run organization, and we certainly are happy to provide whatever help we can if Americans are interested in that information.
I'm curious, one thing I saw on an agenda, I think that you were bringing up with your cohorts down there, or your counterparts down there, is driverless cars, because they're coming on so quickly. Like, what's the state of how could we be seeing driverless cars going across the border soon? Like, take me to Rochester, New York or something? Is that coming on the horizon?
Well, it will eventually, and it's coming at us probably quicker than we think. And that's the reason we did bring that up as well. Again, a question of harmonizing our regulations, because certainly the auto industry, and not only the auto industry, but the information technology industries, the Googles and the Apples of this world, the Teslas and others, are working at a very feverish pace to develop automated vehicles. And those, of course, have to work within a set of regulations. And with cars in the future crossing our borders, obviously we want to make sure that it works well on both sides of the border. Again, that points to the importance of us regulating in a harmonious way on both sides.
All right. Let's see what happens. That's coming fast. All right, Mark Garneau, thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Don.
All right, after the break, our journalists wrap up the show with some upbeat economic news and what it means for the upcoming federal budget. And my last word looks at the case of a conservative leadership candidate who doesn't seem to believe her own campaign message. Please stay with us. Welcome back. The Thursday Press Gang is here to discuss the good news of a stronger-than-expected Canadian economy, although Bill Curry, who writes for the Globe and Mail, just said maybe not so fast on that one. Craig Oliver is a CTV's political commentator. He joins us as well. What? You said, you came in and said to me earlier today, it's good news for Canada. It's not?
Well, so today we had the new GDP numbers for the last quarter of 2016. They beat all the economic forecasts, so all the economists are revising their forecasts. These averages are what Bill Morneau uses for his budget, so presumably that would be a little bump for him. But what we learned throughout the day, a little reporting, is that I found out that the budget is not going to use these new numbers. They're actually going to use the survey from 2 months ago. Huh. So that was, if you recall, it kind of got into this whole, all these rumors about an early budget was because Bill Morneau had this meeting with the private sector economist January 13. Mm-hmm. It was a month earlier than he normally does. It's still not clear why he did it so early. Everybody assumed he would have had to update them given that all this time has passed without a budget. We still don't have a budget date. But no, they're sticking with those. Presumably, we can read into that they're a little skeptical about these rosy numbers. There's still a lot of uncertainty about what might happen in the United States, and they're choosing to be a bit more cautious.
And growth was not good in the United States either. It was below 2% last year. And as the Bank of Governor said yesterday when they decided to stay pat with interest rates, there's just a lot of uncertainty out there. Canada still doesn't know about a border tax, if it's going to hit us and how badly it would hit us. Mm-hmm. They don't know about the plans for a massive, the president said, tax cut. That would affect Canada, make us less competitive if it's combined, as he's promised, with a big cut in the corporate rate, the corporate mm-hmm. tax mm-hmm. rates. All of these things could really reduce Canadian growth, which is already not great. In fact, economic growth is not very strong anywhere among the G7 countries.
What's he waiting for on this budget, Bill? When we heard March, we heard February, then we heard March 21st, and now some talk of April.
Yeah, there is some talk of April. Even, I mean, that talk, the delay made you think they wanted to wait and see for the better numbers. I had heard that, mm-hmm. so that's why it was kind of surprising to see that they're not going to use these better numbers. I think, you know, waiting is good for all these factors that Craig had pointed out in the United States to solidify, but, you know, Morneau went to Washington yesterday, met with his counterpart, Mr. Mnuchin, did not get any, as he said, he had no details, so he couldn't be critical or praise what he was doing because he didn't find out anything. So they're going to have to go in the dark, and that kind of leans towards, I guess, being more cautious, I think a budget that doesn't have a whole lot of new spending. Maybe you close some programs, rename others, shuffle the deck a little bit, and just wait until the next budget to react to whatever comes out of Washington.
And this all involves very complex negotiations in Washington between Congress and the White House and the bureaucracy. And so I think that he's just got to wait until he knows what the judgments coming out of there are, because Canada, Americans have had no specifics. A lot of talk, but a big gap between the reality, I think, and the kind of talk we're hearing.
Okay, Bill, I tip of the hat. You were the first to confirm a new ambassador coming to Canada. Fill in some blanks for us. How impressive is this particular candidate, and what will she bring to Canada from the Trump White House?
Well, Kelly Knightcraft is the nominee that's going through the process right now. Certainly very well connected. So for Canadian officials here in Ottawa, dealing with her means that this is somebody who knows all the big players in Congress, the Mitch McConnells and Ryans, and she was very close with John Boehner before. So I think that will be interesting. So when you read about her, it's often she's paired with her husband, Joe Kraft, who's a billionaire coal baron. So between them, they've been kind of a power couple in fundraising for the Republican Party. They were a little late to the game to the Trump team, but they did eventually go on under the stipulation that Trump not try to replace the senior leadership in Congress. So you kind of get an idea of where she's coming from. She's not a hardcore Trumpite, but came along as long as he promised not to upset the apple cart too much.
Interesting. She could even lay those conditions down on him. Okay, great.
Well, I think she can be one of the more effective ambassadors we've had here in many years, in the sense that she is more broadly based with the party that she comes up here representing and the White House she's representing than some other ambassadors have been, in the sense that her connection is not just the White House, it's with the whole mainstream. She goes right back to George Bush, who made her a delegate to the U.S. delegation to the United Nations. Mm-hmm. She's a serious person in her own right. And being a woman, I think there's a very interesting connection with what the President of the United States and our Prime Minister seem to be so fond of, as mentioned in the speech the other night, the idea of women entrepreneurship, finding more jobs for women, and this initiative they've begun. She will also be very involved with that, which kind of gives Canada a connection all the time to the President's daughter over a long period of time. So that could be valuable. Also, she was the deputy of in charge of the inaugural for the president. She's well connected with him, and you know how obsessive he is apparently about loyalty. So in choosing her, he's sending a message to the Canadians saying, this woman's my woman in your place.
Just before I let you guys go, Craig, a quick thought from you. I mean, you've seen enough administrations come and go in the States and how Canada interacts with them. What's your general sense of how Trudeau's doing so far with the Trump?
What can you say? I mean, I think they've done everything right. They've connected at every level you can connect. They've worked with all of the governors. Mm-hmm. They've hit all of the major players at the White House. The meeting went well. It just couldn't have gone better than it did. Mm-hmm. And it's going to mean that if they're going to do things that are going to hurt Canada, there are at least going to be serious second thoughts around the White House and in Congress about doing that. That's a big plus for us. Okay. And the governors are obviously laying in because they're affected, too, with Congress, who make all the decisions about trade. People forget that.
We're out of time. Thank you, guys. We'll see you next week. Now it's time for the last word. Well, during a 2004 Stephen Harper campaign pit stop in southwestern Ontario, an intensely earnest woman kept circulating the media entourage, making sure we were sufficiently impressed with the future Prime Minister's speech. She stood out from the usual fan fanatics because she worked as a pediatric surgeon when not moonlighting as a political junkie. That was Kelly Leach then. The Kelly Leach now fighting to become Harper's replacement as party leader would never recognize what she has become. Talk to MPs who know Leach, and the first thing they'll say is that this candidate, now fixated on values policing immigrants, banging Donald Trump's anti-elitism drum, advertising on alt-right American websites, and producing a cringe-worthy video which oozes insincerity, she is a fake Leach. She was, and in her earlier life, a compassionate, charitable, charismatic personality who saved or repaired hundreds of young lives while educating other doctors on advanced surgical skills. That does not compute with the person in this week's bizarre Facebook production. I wholeheartedly recommend a video viewing, not because it explains her same old immigration vetting policy, but because the production so perfectly captures the horror of this politically tortured soul. As any backroom operator will tell you, the worst campaign strategy is one where the candidate doesn't really believe what they're selling voters. The second biggest mistake is making that obvious. To watch Leach flesh out her script with long, eyeball-roving silences, which were meant to be dramatic but look awkwardly awful, is to see a candidate twisting on marionette strings while focus group analysts make her lips move. Some twisted minds will argue it is mission accomplished to produce a video that becomes must-see material in the middle of a crowded and hotly contested leadership brawl. But surely there's more to lose than to gain when that exposure is driven by people seeking a laugh, a snort, or mocking material for social media. Leach so completely misses that reality that she opened this week's debate urging viewers to witness her own petard hoisting. It seems unlikely Leach has enough support to win on the first ballot and unlikely to be anyone's second choice on the preferential ballot. Her bid appears doomed. Had the early incarnation of Kelly Leach pulled off a victory, the Conservatives would have had a fighting chance. But if leadership candidate Leach seizes the reins of official opposition leader, she will suffer a caucus exodus, endless Liberal ridicule, and a lingering public backlash, which will defy all her surgical skills to repair. And that's the last word, and that's it for today's Political Power Plays. Mirella Fernandez is standing by with the latest news headlines. Momar Sachedina is back tomorrow with all the big moves from Parliament Hill across the country and around the world. Hoping you'll join us again at this time on CTV News Channel.